All right, guys. Well, thank you for joining us this morning. There's a few more folks here that I did not see last week, so whether or not they're third service folks jumping into second service or whether we're growing in headcount, I'm not sure, but welcome. Appreciate you being a part of this. Welcome to week three. If you can sit at a table where there's someone else already there, we're going to have a little bit of discussion time today. Not trying to peer pressure you to being social, but if you want to join a table where someone else is already sitting, that would be great. Cool. So I'm actually going to start off by just giving you guys a little bit of a chance to interact with each other. Here's what I want to do before we dig into session three of our four-week series. Before we dig in, I want you to take a time to just introduce yourself to the folks at your table. And then after that, can you maybe share one thing around your table that you've taken away from our first 2 weeks together? What's one thing that you have learned that you've benefited from or that you've enjoyed learning or engaging on? So what's one thing you've taken away from the first 2 weeks together? And then is there anything you have in terms of hopes for the remainder of our time together? Is there anything you want to try to make sure we get out of the study that we haven't addressed yet, okay? So take 3 or 4 or 5 minutes, just get to know the folks at your table. If you can address both of these questions as well, that would be great. Your turn. Go. All right, we ready to go? Let's jump back together. I wouldn't mind hearing from a couple of you. Maybe on the second question, one thing that struck you so far in our time together, who among you would be willing to share one of your takeaways, something that's impacted you in a couple of weeks we've been together so far?
I didn't realize that almost half of them
have
seminary degrees.
Uh-huh. Yep. Yep. Great. Yeah. The number of founding fathers that had degrees from seminaries. Yeah. All right. What's another thing that you've taken away from our time together? Something else that struck you?
How Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, who basically didn't believe in God as their Savior, at least they didn't profess that, still said it was a thing that people should emulate, and it was good for the country, and to have an existing, long-lasting country, you had to have a hope in God.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, even our founding fathers that paid a little lip service towards Christianity still definitely saw the utility value in it and felt it was essential for our country to be successful. Yeah, great. Anyone else?
So, it kind of ties those two together. Mm-hmm. But the respect that was allotted to people who were of God, with like godly principles. So that's how they were choosing their leaders at first.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Very good. Anyone else? Okay. Let's turn to the last question. Are there anything you guys have in your mind that you have for hopes for the remaining 2 weeks for our session? Stuff that you want to make sure that we get to or that we touch on before our session concludes next week? Some of the reason why I'm asking this is I haven't completed the content for week 4 fully, and so I want to make sure that we kind of get this in part to where you want us to land. I've got a direction in my head of where I want to go with next week, but I also want to make sure that I'm hitting the desired outcomes for you guys. So did anything come up at your table for the third question? Any hopes for the remainder of our time together? Oh, come on. Yes?
Well, we didn't get to the third one, but the question I've had since we began is, mm-hmm. All right, so they had a faith in God. They all had an understanding of divine providence in bringing this nation together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We've moved so far,
mm-hmm.
that they would say, "Yeah, well, they were all slaveholders. They did, you know, they were all screwed up. We, did, you know, so we can just gonna." So, how do we relate all of this information to the current culture? I guess.
Gotcha. Good. How do we relate the information? Okay. Anyone else? Anyone else have a desired outcome or a hope for the next couple of weeks, this week and next week? Roger.
I guess I was interested in the recent trend with the Supreme Court being more favorable to a Christian viewpoint.
Uh-huh.
Whether there's trends that are reversing culture.
That's good.
You know, Bibles back in schools, maybe abortion being overturned, that kind of stuff.
Okay. Good. Okay. Anyone else? Yeah.
Just going off of stuff that's happened this week and the New York City, you know, what New York did, and how a few states have now done their states' rights,
mm-hmm.
things, which is kind of what the Christians have said we should be doing, states' rights instead of
mm-hmm.
from federal rights.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. States are now doing very radical things.
Interesting. Okay. Yep.
So going back to like some of the court cases, which some of them were a little preposterous, but going mm-hmm. back to the court cases that mm-hmm. you had shared that
mm-hmm.
really defined that those beliefs were imperative and important to those decisions that were made and how they set precedences.
Mm-hmm.
Then common law requires that precedence to be
Yeah, what happened to all the precedent we had accumulated? Yeah. Good question.
Mm-hmm.
You got it. Exactly. Okay, great. That's helpful. Good. Thank you for a couple of ideas on that, and that's going to be helpful for me. Some of this we're actually going to get to today, and some of it we will get to next week. So I appreciate that. Just by a quick way of review, this was kind of the picture that we landed on in the sketch from last week. You know, as I think back on what, you know, we've all probably taken away different things in the study. And for me, the thing that was most helpful, the portion of the preparation that I've benefited from most personally was just the whole understanding of this triangle, and specifically the whole idea that the founders felt that our Constitution wouldn't hold up to an immoral people. I thought that was a fascinating thing, like to hear John Adams saying that, you know, if our people are not moral, if they're not bridled by religion and morality, then the strongest cords of our Constitution will be broken the way that a whale goes through a net. I thought that was just an incredible metaphor. And this struck me too, the whole idea of the paradox of freedom, right? The idea that unrestrained freedom actually undermines freedom. Lloyd even, it's interesting, in our church service this morning, I'm not sure if you're at the 8 o'clock service, but Lloyd actually talked about what is freedom. It almost played right into our content. But, you know, the idea that when everything is permissible, no one is truly free. We've got millions of people in the land of the free that are in recovery groups right now from an overindulgence in their freedom, right? So we discovered, and we looked at last week, that unless freedom has some self-imposed boundaries, it can result in a kind of slavery, all right? And I love the metaphor that Tocqueville used last week, where he said, how can a people be free if the moral tie is not strengthened as the political tie is relaxed? I thought that was a really interesting way of thinking about the necessity for how will we be a free people unless we really ingrain morality into our citizens. We'll refer back a little bit to the triangle, right, as we go on today. Now, the founding fathers, as we looked at the court cases, as we looked at their personal views towards religion, we've discovered that even though we live in the land of the free, and the bottom left corner of that triangle, as it points kind of upwards and to the left, right, there is a relationship between faith and religion and freedom, right? There had to be a free relationship there. The founding fathers could not decree a state religion. The people had to freely choose it. It might feel a little bit like the founding fathers are speaking a little bit out of both sides of their mouth, because they're allowing the people to freely choose religion, and yet they're saying, here's kind of the one that we've chosen for you, right? We want the Bible in our schools. We want there to be religious instruction taught in our classrooms. So I want to spend a little bit of time today talking about the First Amendment, because this is where a lot of our redefinition in terms of precedent set and in terms of where we took a hard left turn. It was around the wording around the First Amendment specifically. Now, my daughters in school are learning this right now, so I've got this on top of my head, but how many of you can remember, like, what does the First Amendment to our Constitution touch on? What are the different things that the First Amendment specifically speaks to? Freedom of what? Speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of religion, yep, and press, you got it. Yeah, free to petition the government, free to assemble, freedom of speech, and freedom of religion. So, and the question becomes, when was the First Amendment written? Like, how far after the Constitution was finished in 1787 did the First Amendment emerge? It was only 2 years later. So the debate for the First Amendment lasted from June 7th to September 25th of 1789. Less than 2 years after the Constitution was finalized. That's about 100 and some days. There were 90 of the founding fathers that were locked in a room to hammer out the First Amendment, which is interesting because the First Amendment, at least the portion that we're going to look at today, it's not real long, okay? Now, this is only the portion that pertains to religion, the sections that pertain to freedom of press, freedom of assembly. Obviously, I've left those out of our discussion today, okay? By the way, what's interesting is that the record of these proceedings, it's available to us. There's a long, lengthy list of exactly what was discussed every day, what the outcomes were every day, and so forth. This is available to you. Now, When you read the First Amendment, in fact, let's just read it together, all right? Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, okay? It's very clear the First Amendment is designed to restrict and to put limitations on the federal government. When it says Congress, that's what it's talking about. All right, so let's dive into this for a second. I think I put a couple fill in the blanks on your handout. I'm not a real big fill in the blank teacher, but a couple areas here where I'm going to have you write a couple things in. The first part of the First Amendment, there's two different clauses. The first one is called the Establishment Clause. All right, and when it says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, what does that mean? Well, an established religion, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. This just means that whoever's in charge of our country, whoever's running the place, president and Congress, they cannot decree an official state religion. They can't do that. All of our founders left this in Europe, okay? And if you know your history books very well, you know the carnage that Europe suffered through as a result of there being abuses in this regard. The lower left corner of our triangle, again, was the relationship between freedom and religion. Our founders were really firm on that because there was no shortage of examples throughout all of Europe where, let's just say, the king decides, okay, I am Protestant, and now, therefore, everyone who is in my country, now you're going to be Protestant. And then his heir, and let's just take King Henry VIII as an example, his daughter, Mary, assumes the throne, and she says, nope, we are all Catholic. And what was Mary's nickname, by the way? Bloody Mary. Why? Because she didn't tolerate people who weren't Catholic. And then another person assumed the throne. Okay, now we're going to be Protestant. In fact, we're going to be Anglican specifically. And there was just a whole bunch of carnage, and it was yucky, and a lot of people lost their lives. And we discovered just by watching example that for religion to work, for faith to work, it has to be freely chosen. You might even think there's times when this might kind of work in our favor, that there might be positive outcomes that come from this. Go back to the early New Testament times. Can you picture in Acts chapter 6 the stoning of Stephen, right? Stephen was killed, right, by a mob, basically, that Saul of Tarsus was kind of overseeing at that time. He lost his life, right, to basically someone who was just a whole bunch of guys that were bullying up on him. But there wasn't official persecution by the state at that time. There was just sort of random mob goings on at that time. Well, though that was the kind of persecution that the Christians suffered very early on in our New Testament timeline, as of 64 AD, after the burning of Rome, Christianity fell under official persecution. We were the enemies of the state at that time. And Christians were literally hunted down. And we were all meeting in underground hidden ways. It was a very uncomfortable time to be alive as a Christian. And that lasted from about 64 all the way until a guy became the emperor in 313 that would officially end the persecution on Christianity. Do you know what his name was? Constantine. Yep, Constantine. So in 313, he becomes the emperor of Rome. And he officially ends the persecution on Christianity, but he swung the pendulum the other way. What do you think he did in terms of enforcing his Christian beliefs? Christianity was now basically going to be the state religion, right? And there's stories, I'm not sure how widespread this was because the Roman Empire was huge, but there's stories of Constantine's armies marching people by sword point and spear point into the rivers of baptism, right? So we kind of went too far the other way. How glad were the people to be Christians if they're marched into the waters of baptism under threat, right? Probably not. So guys, this has never worked well. Whenever religion has been forced, it has never had positive outcomes, okay? So the founders were very clear. Congress, again, this is referring to who? The federal government shall make no laws respecting an establishment of religion. That means if our president happens to be Anglican, maybe they're Methodist or Catholic, Lutheran, whatever. If we have a Muslim president, if we have a Roman Catholic president, if we have a Buddhist president, no matter what happens, we cannot force a state religion in America. That's what the First Amendment is saying in the Establishment Clause. Now, the second clause is called the Free Exercise Clause. What is free exercise? Well, to some of you in the room, that means that you don't need to report to the YMCA in the morning and pay for a gym membership or go to Gold's Gym. You can just put in a DVD in the morning and get you some free exercise. All right, that was a lame attempt at humor. All right. No, this is not what the free exercise clause means. All right. The free exercise clause specifically is that Congress shall make no law prohibiting the free exercise of religion, right? So read that slowly. Congress, again, the federal government, shall make no law prohibiting the free exercise of religion. So no law can prohibit the free exercise of our religion. The federal government can't prevent us from expressing our religion. That's what this is saying. Now, when you think of what's the free exercise of our religion? What's an example of that? What's one thing that should be considered an exercise of our religion? Going to church. What else? Praying. What else?
Preaching the gospel.
Sure. Absolutely. Evangelism. Reading the Bible. This is the things we do to express our religion, right? And just to... this is going to get blurry as we move through today. That's why I want crystal clarity on this. Congress, the federal government, will not prohibit us from freely exercising our religion. Okay? Now, this is going to change, not the terms, not the amendment itself, but how the amendment is understood. We're going to look at this as we progress throughout our time together today. All right? The federal government, their job is to protect religious expression, right? Religious exercise, right? Why are they protected? Because they may not limit it, right? They cannot interfere with it. They cannot prohibit the expression of it. Now, as we look at America today, something has happened. Something has happened to our virtue, right? We know that our founders' vision has shifted a little bit over the years because the means by which the founders have sought to establish virtue within our populace, it's become as a part of the target of attack. Somewhere along the line, said another way, our free expression of our religion has been shunned. Okay, and when I read certain publications, I went online and did a lot of reading on this today. It's interesting to see that some of the people who are critical of religion, when they talk about the role of religion in America, some of the modern historians today, they almost look back on our religious heritage the way that they look back on slavery in America. It's kind of this embarrassing part of our past that we're ashamed of. That's how some people are regarding religion today. Now, what I'm hoping to accomplish in our session is I want to look at what was the point of departure? Where did we get off track? And I want to tell you that this is going to look a little bit like an earthquake. There was tectonic shifts that had tectonic plates that had a lot of pressure on them, and there was one preliminary rumble, and then there was boom. There was two big things that lit up the Richter scale, and after that we have a series of aftershocks. That's kind of the metaphor I want you to have in your head: a preliminary warning rumble, a big earthquake, and then a series of aftershocks. Here's the warning rumble. Okay, this was in 1947. This is from a Supreme Court case called Everson versus the Board of Education. So I'm going to raise my stand here a little bit. Everson versus the Board of Education. And this was a case put forth, obviously, by a guy named Mr. Everson. And he lived in New Jersey. And Mr. Everson had a next-door neighbor who he discovered his kids were going to private Christian school. All right? No big deal. That was their choice. But Everson discovered that his next-door neighbor was receiving reimbursements from the state of New Jersey for the costs of his kids using public transportation to get to school, right? There's no yellow school buses that picked up the kids to go to private Christian school. That was only for the public schools. But Everson's neighbor was getting small refunds back from the state of New Jersey because Everson's neighbor's kids had to ride public transportation. And he said, "Come again? My tax dollars are doing what?" And so Everson thought that this constituted state support of religion, right? He didn't like the fact that his tax dollars are being appointed towards what he felt was the state sponsorship of religion. And what happened is that when this went to the Supreme Court, it went to the state court first and it was approved. Everson won his case, and then it went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And in a 5-4 decision, a very close decision, this decision broke with about 160 years of established precedent, right? What was the ruling on this thing? Well, the Supreme Court ruled that the First Amendment, they said, have erected a wall between church and state. That wall must be kept high and impregnable. We could not approve the slightest breach. Now, when you read the First Amendment, was there anything in the First Amendment wording that talked about a wall erected between church and state? Was that in the First Amendment? Have you heard the phrase, wall of separation between church and state? Most of you in your schooling might have associated that term, wall of separation between church and state, as being part of the understanding of the First Amendment, but it's not in the First Amendment. Isn't that interesting? That terminology actually comes from a private correspondence letter between Thomas Jefferson and a couple of friends of his, but it was a letter that was written 13 years after the First Amendment was written. That wording cannot be found in it. Nonetheless, Everson said this is a violation of the Establishment Clause. He said that this is a violation of the Establishment Clause, that the state of New Jersey is setting up what he believed was a state-sponsored religion, and he did not like his tax dollars being appropriated for this purpose. Now, what's interesting to me in this is that the wall of separation, if there is one, if we want to use that metaphor, it's drawn at the federal government line. It's not drawn at the state line. The states have always been allowed to show favor, to express privileges towards the churches, to the religions, but it was always held prior to this at the federal level. Well, now as a result of this, it was the wall, let's just say the wall was going to shift in the direction now towards the states, okay? Now, this is the initial rumble. This is the initial rumble that we don't like the idea of money being appropriated even at the state level to be able to sponsor or to help religious pursuits, right? Let's look at the first rumble of the actual earthquake itself, okay? This is the shift. Let me get to this in a second. I think I put my slides in the wrong order. Sorry, guys. I thought this was after the next slide. All right. So this is essentially what happened in this ruling. The state wall, right? The wall of separation between church and state, it was designed to limit the federal government. That's what Thomas Jefferson had designed. And the shift of this now in this 5-4 decision, so this high and impregnable wall, was now going to be included in the state's understanding of the clause of, I'm losing my wording here. I'm sorry, what did you say? The Establishment Clause. Yeah, sorry, I didn't put that in my notes here. So the states were now to observe the Establishment Clause as well as the federal government, okay? Now, let's move on to the next one. 1962, there was a ruling called Engle versus Vital. And this is one that's fairly infamous because this is one where our prayer fell under attack in the public schools. In our public schools until this time, prayer had always been conducted. It was always voluntary, but it was led by the teachers in our public schools, right? In 1962, it was challenged as to whether or not it was constitutional for prayer to be conducted amidst our public schools. And the prayer that caused this stir was a 22 prayer that you have in your handout. It says, Almighty God, we acknowledge our dependence upon thee, and we beg thy blessings upon us, our parents, our teachers, and our country. 22 words. Simple 22-word prayer. How many times does it mention God in this prayer? Just once. It's the same number of times that God is referenced in our Pledge of Allegiance. It's only a quarter of the number of times that God is referenced in our Declaration of Independence. But this, too, was considered a violation of the Establishment Clause because it felt like the schools are dictating an establishment of religion in the classroom. And what's interesting, when you look at this, you don't think of prayer as being an establishment, right? You think of prayer being a free exercise portion. If there's a violation of the First Amendment here, it would be, we're engaging in free exercise. We're praying. But in a landmark decision, the justices in the Supreme Court in 962, they ruled that church establishment would not just mean religious institution, it would also refer to religious activity. Any religious activity was a reflection of church establishment. And then as a result of this, it was considered that the federal government was, we were setting up a denomination, which certainly, of course, prayer did not do, right? This was the modern turning point, guys, in the understanding of the First Amendment. The Establishment Clause went from being a religious institution, being a religious denomination, to thinking of it as being religious activities. And this was a significant break, obviously, from prior precedent. But what's interesting in the court ruling in 1962 is that the ruling by these justices, it really didn't provide precedent to base this decision on. They kind of marched off in their own direction. It was a departure from prior court rulings that had existed. Additional, what was interesting in this one is not only is this decision noteworthy for the reinterpretation of the First Amendment, for the departure from precedent, the fact that they didn't back up their decision by providing precedent for the decision, but the dissenting justices, this was another 5-4 decision, the dissenting Supreme Court justices took the time to actually gauge what percentage of the United States of America were God-believing people. What percentage of our population you think believed in God in 1962? Oh, do I have it right on there? Yeah. 97. I didn't know I had it on the handout. 97% of our people believed in God in 1962. That means that there's only 3% of our entire populace would have actually been offended by this 22-word prayer. Only 3%. And yet, because of that 3%, prayer was kicked out of our schools. Prior to this decision, 3% had always been considered a minority. But this decision, it kind of ushered in a new era whereby the political philosophy of a small dissent group would begin to become the standard by which the rest of the nation would govern its public affairs. You remember from a week or two ago, we talked about part of the American spirit is that we don't like it when the little guy is getting pushed around by the big guy. Remember when we talked about that? I wonder if that's playing out a little bit in decisions like this, that the Supreme Court might have felt that the little guy is getting pushed around by the big guy. As you know, if you're watching what's happening in the political circles at all, that the small dissent groups are really becoming the direction that we're moving towards as a nation. And this is going to be something that will become a trend for the many years to follow. So 1962, that was the first big hit on the Richter scale in terms of earthquake. The next hit on the Richter scale was not quite a year later, 1963. A court case called Abington versus Shemp. Now, this one did two things. Number one, it reaffirmed the removal of prayer in our schools, but it decided to broaden the prohibition to include the Bible as a core textbook in our classrooms. And you might recall that this is a pretty radical reversal of the expressed will and intent of our founders, who decreed that the Bible would be a standard text in our schools, right? We saw Supreme Court cases where folks had said, hey, I'm willing to give you all this money. I'm willing to open a school. Don't teach the Bible. And those court cases were shot down because the Bible was required teaching in our schools. There was a country mile of precedent of why the Bible should be a required book in our schools, right? This was way more radical than removing prayer because the amount of precedent that had established this in our system was significant. So how did the court in 1963 justify the removal of Bible reading in our schools? What's interesting is that the Supreme Court relied on the testimony of a single person, a child psychologist, who said this: if portions of the New Testament were read without explanation, they could be harmful to the child. That's it. A new line of precedent was created. If portions of the New Testament were read without explanation, it could be harmful to the child. No longer were our courts, our Supreme Court, was it interested in, concerned about the law and the Constitution. The Supreme Court sort of nominated itself as chief child psychologist, and quite simply, we moved in a different direction as of that day. One of the dissenting justices on our Supreme Court is a man named Potter Stewart. He wrote a lengthy dissenting opinion, and in it he cited the very clear fact that the Supreme Court begins every day with the declaration, God save this honorable court. He also noted in his opinion that every single day that Congress begins a session, they begin with prayer, a tradition that continues to this day. But nonetheless, the court was simply ready to move in a different direction. Translation, the majority of the nine of us on the Supreme Court are ready to take America this way. Your vote matters, right? Some of you have heard the name Madeleine Murray O'Hare. She's a pretty famous atheist who's also got all up in arms because her son was required to pray and read a Bible in school. You've probably heard of her. Her case was bundled with this case, Abington versus Shemp, at the Supreme Court level, and they were ruled on simultaneously on both. Okay? Give you a couple more, and then we'll take a pause. So these are the two big things that hit the Richter scale. Yeah? It was 5-4. 1980. We've got another one. This is Stone versus Graham. This one's interesting. The Supreme Court in 1980 addressed whether students could continue to look at the Ten Commandments while they were at school, right? We're not teaching them. We're not teaching them. The question is, could we have the Ten Commandments on school grounds? Could they be looked at, could they be looked upon similar to the way one of your students would look at a portrait of George Washington, right? Are we okay with this? The court ruled as follows. If the posted copies of the Ten Commandments are to have any effect at all, it would be to induce the school children to read, to meditate upon, perhaps even to venerate and obey the Ten Commandments. This is not a permissible state objective. 1980. So the court is saying in 1980, we can't let this thing be seen, right? If students look at the Ten Commandments, they might read it. They might meditate upon it. God forbid they may obey it, and that would be unconstitutional. I don't know about you, but thank goodness we are sparing our children from such controversial teachings as honoring their parents, avoiding lying, avoiding stealing, don't kill. Thank goodness we have spared them from such hardship. Yeah, that's 1980, all right? Now, I want to back the clock up just a little bit. I was going to do this in timeline, but here's one that happened once we got rid of the Bible and prayer in schools as well, and that's Roe versus Wade. You guys all know this one. This was the decision that legalized the abortion in our country. How many of you can guess how many children have been aborted in our country since Roe versus Wade?
They say 1 out of 3.
How many?
50 million.
50 million? That's a lot, huh? I pulled this up yesterday. This is actually updated weekly. You can just Google it. 60,069,971 babies as of last week have been aborted since Roe versus Wade in 1973. Okay, that's roughly the population of France. That's roughly the population of Italy. Slightly less than the population of the UK. Now, if you do the math on this, here's our population of our country. If you look at the number of babies we've aborted, it's about 20% of our country we have aborted. Isn't that incredible? Yeah.
We used to work at a crisis pregnancy center, and the statistics is one of every three people you see, one of them has been aborted.
Wow.
It might make you a little bit more cognizant when you look around people and say, well, there should be another person.
Mm-hmm. It's crazy. I don't want to dwell too much on this, but I want to share just a short story if I can. When you talk about a lot of these things that we're going to look at, and I want to bring us into our discussion next week, I feel like we're not holding ground like as believers. We're not holding the ground very well. So when you look at the policies in the schools of our children, let's just give you an example of this, all right? Who here has a daughter between the ages of 12 and 17? Anyone have a daughter that age, 12 to 17? You're an 11-year-old. Okay, I've got a 13-year-old and I've got a 15-year-old. Okay, so there's a few of us in the room. Do you know that if your little girl at school has a headache, that she's not allowed to get a Tylenol from the nurse without your permission? You familiar with that? Right, that's the school nurse is at risk of engaging in battery if she gives medication to your child without your express permission, because you own as the parent the medical health of the child, right? Despite that, do you know that if your little girl is found to be pregnant, that she can go to the guidance counselor at the school? She can say, I think I might be pregnant. The guidance counselor can offer her a pregnancy test, and if it's found that she's pregnant, the guidance counselor can drive her to a pregnancy center to learn about her options, and if she chooses to have an abortion, the child can come back at the school nurse or the school counselor transporting her, can receive an abortion, can have a procedure that will scar her physically and emotionally for the rest of her life, will deliver her back to the school, and you as a parent don't even have the right to know. Isn't that crazy? But we can't give them Tylenol.
Also,
isn't that crazy?
Birth control.
Speak up, Bernie.
Birth control. Your daughter can be taken in for birth control. And the doctor cannot say a word to the parents.
And you don't have the right to know. We'll talk about this a little bit next week, but the people who we would loosely classify as being our opponents in some of these arenas, they're very well organized. They're very well armed. Armed in terms of they know how to fight for their position. And we'll talk about this next week, but we're losing a lot of ground, and then sometimes we don't even know that we're losing it. The fact that my daughter could receive an abortion, and I don't even have the permission to know as a parent, tells me that there's been a lot of movement that's happened without my knowledge as a dad. Okay? Anyways, I could list a ton of rulings that would demonstrate to you how we've lost ground in our country, different court rulings that would show that the things that our founding fathers held dearly to have been stripped away over time. So, yes, sir.
Are you going to touch on the idea of religion versus Christianity? So at the expense, you know, we're taking hits on the Christian front,
mm-hmm.
but there's also a lot of coalescence to other religions.
Mm-hmm. I might get to that next week. Yeah, so the idea that there's actually some other religions that are being given great freedoms
yeah.
in the public square and in the classroom. Great call. I'll make sure I try to touch on that next week, Gary.
Great, thanks.
Good. Okay. All right, so here's a question for you. I don't remember what the world was like back in the 40s, back in the 60s. You know, some of you in the room might be able to weigh in a little bit on what that was like, and you've probably have kind of witnessed this slow decay of some of these things over the years. I remember watching a movie with my daughter, Elizabeth, last year. There's a kind of a takeoff movie that combines a lot of fairy tales together. It's called Into the Woods. Have you guys heard of this movie called Into the Woods? It blends a number of fairy tales together. I was watching this with my daughter, and my jaw almost hit the floor because it's an extremely modernized version of some fairy tales. And in it, Prince Charming and Cinderella are talking about their relationship. And what was interesting in this movie is that Prince Charming cheats on Cinderella. And when Cinderella questions him on it, he says, "I'm charming, I'm not sincere." And it was just so casual, so just plain spoken, that I'm like, oh my goodness, this is being considered normal. And this is the information that's being put in front of our children. It's a snapshot of the state of our culture today, right? Now, we can probably give a ton of different examples of how our culture feels different in terms of morality today compared to, you know, 50 years ago. But I wonder how we would measure the difference in our morality, right? So I would love you just to take a couple minutes at your tables. Can you just brainstorm? What are some of the ways you think that we would be able to literally measure some things that would be different today than they would have been before the Bible was kicked out of schools, before prayer was kicked out of schools, etc., right? So what would be a measurable impact from the Bible and religious instruction being removed from our schools and our public squares? What would a measurable difference be in America as a result of this? Can you just take 2 minutes at your table and see if you can brainstorm what some of these measurable differences might be? Because we're going to look at some statistics here in just a little bit, okay? So just brainstorm what some of the categories would be where there'd be differences in measurable data as a result of this. Minute, guys. 1 minute. All right. What are some areas you think statistically we might be different now in the era post-Bible, post-prayer, and the removal of religious expression in the public square? What are some data points that would shift up or down? Someone start. Decreased crime or increased crime? You think crime will go down because we've eliminated the Bible from schools? Okay. So increase in crime. All right, what's another one? All right. Incarceration. Thank you. What else?
Increased juvenile delinquency, juvenile halls, incarceration.
All right, someone else? What do we hear? What'd you come up with? Okay. All right, what else?
I don't know if this is a data point, but as we have shifted away from that model of what the family is and in the church and having that in our schools,
uh-huh.
We have a lot more fatherless homes.
Hmm. Fatherless homes. That's good. Divorces. What else?
Suicide.
All right. Anyone else?
Brent mentioned a work ethic, which contributes to absenteeism,
economic honor.
Cool.
Increased cheating on your taxes.
Okay. We'll call that delinquency. Yeah. Yeah.
Personal security blocks the things that we do on a day to day basis that we didn't even think about 30 years ago. Oh, is the car locked? Is the door locked? Is the house mm-hmm. locked? Is the window locked? Is
mm-hmm. everything. Just the feel of it, right? Yeah. Yep. We could go for a while on this. I'm looking at the clock, and I want to be mindful of. Let me just pull up some statistics. And by the way, there's a book out there that was published. This was back in 1991. It's called America, To Pray or Not to Pray. We're back in 1991. Someone went and did some research. How has our nation shifted since the removal of prayer in our schools? So some of the data we're going to be looking at is from that book. Of course, that's 1991. So some of it will be looking at data points from other ones. And you guys actually have more categories than I pulled data on. But let me just give you some examples, all right? Percent of total births in the United States to unmarried women, okay? You can see where that upward trajectory began. It was definitely somewhere in the 1960s where that began to take off significantly, right? Rates of divorce, right? Where did that bell curve adjust? In the 1960s. Premarital sex, actually, this is from the book. You can actually kind of see where the religious principles were kicked out of our schools. Premarital sex for the different ages goes up notably. Birth rates for unwed girls, 15 to 19. Again, you can see right where the shift occurred. How about case of sexually transmitted diseases? Right. You want to look at violent crime? Where did that stop keeping pace with the population growth? In the 1960s. You could look at things like incarceration. This one actually was a bit of a delayed effect. That was pushed out a little bit to the 70s. And I'm sure if we were to look at some of the other areas specifically around the items that you guys had referenced, I think we would find probably similar trends. These are just the ones that I pulled off of the internet and from this book, To Pray or Not to Pray. I'm not trying to create a compelling case for this is the day and the hour that it changed, but it is interesting that we see a lot of these shifts in the data happening within about a 10-year time frame of the Bible and prayer being eliminated from our schools. Please.
Because I've heard this argument from people.
Yes, sir.
When did we start officially taking data? And is it possible that they just weren't keeping track of it before then and they started keeping track of it? Is that true or not true?
Yeah, so I'd have to go back specifically. I know in this one book, America to Pray or Not to Pray, they're looking at kind of, let's look at this sort of 20 years before-ish and then measure to today. On some of these things like incarceration, that goes back a good bit. I'd have to look at the font, but that looks like it's 1900.
Well, back in 1900, how were we keeping track of it?
Yeah, I wasn't the guy that put together the data.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I'm hearing you. There's certainly a risk of people manipulating with statistics to make it read the way that they want it to read, for sure. I know one of the things I was looking at, what was it? There was one data point that went up and then started the curve back down. And others showed a different trend. It's like, okay, who do you believe when we're looking at data? And is it being spun in a certain way to kind of create a point? There's certainly a risk for that. When we look at the number of people, though, who are receiving divorce, that's pretty objective. Number of suicides and so forth, violent crime, it feels like that's fairly objective. But again, I think we need to look at this probably on a case-by-case basis. We know America feels different today. I'm a guy who doesn't like to gauge based off of feelings. I like to look at numbers. I'm kind of a numbers guy, and I prefer to look at data. America has shifted in many ways that I would say are not healthy to the overall thriving of our people. And again, I want to wrap this up because we're already at 10:37, but I always want to be thinking about, as a nation, do we feel like we're moving in a direction, and are we engaging as a country in a way that would allow God to bless us as a country? Do we feel like we would receive God's blessing by the shifts and the redirections that our country has gone into? I get worried when I think about this. I think about the words like George Washington when he put, in 1789, this is his farewell address. Again, the propitious smiles of heaven can never be expected on a nation that disregards the eternal rules of order and right which heaven itself has ordained. What does God in the Bible do with nations that sanction the killing of their children? God's not casual about that. He takes it pretty seriously. At least he did in Old Testament times. I'm not here to preach doom and gloom, but I do know that if we are to expect God's favor and God's blessing, we need to do that which honors God. And we're going to try to conclude next week by looking at, what does that mean in 2019? How do we go forward from this? We know what we have been. We know what our point of departure was from the ideals of our American founding. And we know kind of where we are now. We're going to kind of look at now, and then what do we do from here? I want to end on a reading. I like to finish on quotations. I've got another one that was from Abraham Lincoln, who, as you know, was our president during our Civil War, a time of incredible national strife, like probably unmatched national strife. But that almost makes him a really good voice to speak into this, because I feel like we're headed to a point where we as a country are also headed towards a point of some pretty significant national strife. If you have a pen out, I would like you to underline the parts of this speech that resonate with you, and we're going to end on some time for you guys to chat at your tables, because Lincoln, as you know, has got just a really good insight into a number of things. So look at your handout as we read through this, and then just feel free to underline or circle that which strikes you personally, and then we'll have some time to chat through this when we're done. Lincoln says, "It is the duty of nations to recognize the sublime truth announced in the Holy Scriptures and proven by all history that those nations only are blessed whose God is the Lord. And insomuch as we know that, by his divine law, nations like individuals are subjected to punishments and chastisements in this world, may we not justly fear the awful calamity of civil war, which now desolates the land there may be a punishment inflicted on us for our presumptuous sins to the needful end of our national reformation as a whole people. We have been the recipients of the choicest bounties of heaven. We have been preserved these many years in peace and prosperity. We've grown in numbers, wealth, and power as no other nation has ever grown. But we have forgotten God. We have forgotten the gracious hand which preserved us in peace, which multiplied and enriched us and strengthened us, and we have vainly imagined in the deceitfulness of our own hearts that all these blessings were produced by some superior wisdom or virtue of our own. Intoxicated with unbroken success, we have become too self-sufficient to feel the necessity of redeeming and preserving grace, too proud to pray to the God that made us. It behooves us then to humble ourselves before this offended power, to confess our national sins, and to pray for clemency and forgiveness. All this being done in sincerity and truth, let us then rest humbly in the hope authorized by the divine teachings that the united cry of the nation will be heard on high and answered with blessings no less than the pardon of our national sins and the restoration of our now divided and suffering country to its former happy condition of unity and peace. This was to proclaim a day of prayer and fasting in the middle of the Civil War. Isn't that amazing? So I would ask you just to read through that once more on your own, because like any old writing, sometimes you need to kind of read it through once or twice to process it. I'm going to pray for our time right now, but if you guys can read through that a second time, and feel free to discuss at your table as long as you like. It's 10:40. You can stay as long as you want. I'm just going to pray for our time. And I see you guys engage at your tables to the time that you have available to do so. Lord, thanks for voices of perspective. Thank you for Lincoln. Thank you for guys like John Adams and George Washington and others, Lord, that have spoken truth as stewards of your word. Lord, thank you for the privilege of bearing your name. And Lord, I just ask for clarity in our time together that we would know how to respond. We'd know what our so what is from our time together. We thank you for this opportunity to gather, and we just ask that you would convict us and bless us. In your name we pray. Amen. All right. Enjoy time with your tables.